ciphers and the environmental destruction and the destruction of localization. And I challenged myself to say, okay, so that's what you're against, what are you for? And I was helped to be for something by Patrick Kavanagh's essay, fantastic essay, Mao Zedong Unrolls His Mat, when he said that writers should write from their own parish and be parochial. And I thought that my parish was various understandings of England. So England is a kind of... It's an exploration, a series of trajectories into kind of 1,500 years' worth of English language, history and culture. But it's firmly rooted in a very specific landscape. And I'll start to talk about the first book, the first poem in the sequence, which is The Battle of Brunanburh, which took place in 937. King Athelstan vanquished an invading army of Scots, doubling Norse, and various others, and arguably founded England within something like its current borders at about that time. The site of the Battle of Brunanburh is much disputed, but one of the alternatives is about 25 miles from where I live, in Tinsley Wood near Sheffield. And there's an absurd book written by a local historian, J.C.K. Cockburn, who narrates in great detail his reconstruction of the route of the battle. And the route of the battle goes right across my childhood stamping ground where I used to course hares, hunt rabbits and go bird nesting. I subsequently found that this landscape, which is broadly speaking really common, is actually a sacred landscape. So I'll just read some of the things that were or are on Brierley Common. So the common itself is 600 acres, huge common, virtually completely disappeared now. There was a Good Friday Wakes Fair on there for about 200 years. There was a stone circle in the middle called Ringstone Hill, which has now disappeared. They built a water storage reservoir right on the top of the hill where it was. John Nevis and the highwaymen used to hole up in an inn on the common, and he used to stash his loot, according to local tradition, in a huge oak tree, which we'll scroll around on there, which was called Old Adam. Old Adam was a survivor of two oaks called the Adam and Eve Oaks, in which local people used to go, women who were unable to conceive used to go onto the common and conduct midnight rites, fertility rites there. The two Roman roads go across it. Three Norse wapentakes have their boundaries there. It was a militia muster point. It was a beacon. It's an absolutely resonant landscape. So I imagine the route from the Battle of Brunanburh going across this landscape, which J.C.K. Cockburn assures me is true, but as an amateur historian who was a solicitor for the Coal Board in the 1930s, maybe it didn't happen at all like that, but I choose to believe. So I'll get down to the poetry. So there are four main characters. I'm going to start off with the reading of the first half a dozen or so poems from the Battle of Brunanburh. Four main characters. Two Norsemen trying to escape with their lives. An English horse thane trying to kill people and loot them. And a young boy following the trail. It intercuts with a persona who... broadly related to myself. And so it cuts through time. It's a synchronic look at this landscape. So this is the Battle of Brunanburh. From banks of turbid rother, mucky suds foaming on the autumn spate, through fretwork of osier and screening bulrush, I saw sword edge strike and shield wall splinter on the heath at Brunanburh. Jarls and princes fell. Owain, Strathclyde's king. The slaughter field tussocked with dead. My vision pooled with blood. Garlic thickened in the bankside silts. Rats plopped. Moorhens squawked. Weasels slunk away. Iron set in my crouching bones. Sword slit. Shipman crawling in the surge, waxy as tallow. Current whips him away. Dewfall, blind light. Shouts breaking like stars in the rout to the river. Tumult of thundering horse thanes. And now we have a change in historical period. On way on Duna, Holy Hill, grass slope greased with guts, I creep with purse nets metal detector, the observer's book of birds' eggs. I peg and dig and delve. Whose is this land? The grass grows brittle on leaching bones of Scots. Golf club groundsmen weed and spray. Farmers lurk, keepers oil their shotguns. With needle and cotton, I converted my parka to a coat of many pockets. Catch stitch, back stitch, my opus Anglicanum. On the right of way by, strictly private, I slip away quickly, ignoring shouts and raking torch beams. Partridge pearled, furred with conies, lining full of coin. Athelstan, Rex Toitius Britanniae. And I should have said that this poem is a kind of homage to Geoffrey Hill's Mercy and Hymns, so you might be picking up some allusions in there. That day, the cows were restless. We were up near the ship, spinning for pike, when they started their urgent lowing. They jostled behind us before launching for the river, tipping Tosh and his tackle into the herded flow. They hauled out onto the bank and shook like dogs. A puce-faced farmer came with a bobby and tore up our day tickets. Some lads had killed a calf with idle backs. We packed up our tackle, waited hours in the sun at Ullaskelf station. Scots and shipmen threw down their weapons and leapt into the stream. I watched them founder from the crown of a bankside alder. So now I'm imagining the beginning of the rout, the fleeing invading armies are trying to cross the river with no success. Bank earth colour of a beaver's pelt, pocked with holes. Under the fringing sod, above the kingfisher's oozing cloaca, the spaced oblongs of martins. Waterline, rat tunnels, handholds for drowners, dragged down by flood surge and grappling fingers, backspeared by point-blank javelins. The horsemen wheeled for Brynäsfjord, gravels choked with corpses, festive with looters. We whetted our blades on Hart Hill sidestone and mounted for the slaughter. Hoof splash streaked our backs with blood. Stragglers at Gilthwaite, we cut them down. Spoil there was for taking. Cruxata of Dublin swords, their stinking pelts of mail. Remembering our dead, we pruned noses, clipped genitals, rode garlanded in ears. Morthan, the thing on the moor, Witan of shaken spears. Alternatively, slaughter place, Dingsmere by metathesis. There, breathless pause for bearings. Duskfall, fuming rain, columns from the east, the sound of distant horses. The nailed fleet moored at Castleford. A night and a day by Polaris and Sol, across surgent rivers, through forest and fen, past spoil-greedy hamlets of English and Dane. Napehairs lifting. Snipe tear up from the flood field. Panicking greylags honk aloft. Drumbeat of horses, clash of swords unsheathing. A stump cross sings the slaughter, foamed in wreathy pignut beside the primitive Methodist church. And this is the last poem that I'll read from this sequence. In Tinsley Wood, there used to be a chapel, which still exists, but it exists as Tinsley Parish Church. The village expanded into the wood. And the king, as far back as, I think, the 15th century, had endowed masses to be said in this chapel in the forest, and the historian Michael Wood hypothesized that this endowment of Chantry Masses may have been established by Athelstan because seven people of royal blood were slaughtered in the Battle of Brunanburh. So this last poem spins off that. The king's endowment, lords in the forest chantry, plain song of blackbird and contrapuntal thrush, earthworm and land snail, the cantorist's perpetual stipends. I rose with the song and arranged my relics, the osteoporotic femur from the graveyard of St. Lawrence, the blue stone from the Roman road, skulls of hare and roadkill badger, bastard wings of jays, magpie piety, tongue-tied cult of saints. Bryony's scarlet beads, our father, Hail Mary, rood of corky elder, apocryphal scoring in the beech boar's elephant folio. Pray for the dead, for God's anointed, Alfrich and Athelwin, earls and sons of kings. I'm going to read three poems about birds. Birds have always been very important to me. I've been a kind of bird watcher and a bird nester since I was 2 or 3 years old. And I actually went bird watching in my first collection, Oswald's Book of Hours, the poems in which hardly any are about birds. And I found 46 different species, so I just can't stop writing about birds in there. This poem is called Diamond's White-Tailed Eagle. Diamond was the landowner who lived on Brierley Common. And in 1898, an astonishing thing happened on the common. A white-tailed eagle was seen on the common. So Diamond did what all good landowners would do, and he had his gamekeeper shoot it. And he stuffed it, and it was in his stately home before it became a nursing home. This is about things that die on Brierley Common. It's called Diamond's White-Tailed Eagle, and it's prefaced with a quote from the Battle of Brunanburh, the Anglo-Saxon poem, which is about a white-tailed eagle. Thana hasawampadan irna hafton huit ases brukan gredingna guthavok. Numb-lipped oxen mouthing frostbit sod, stiffening sheep in hoary bracken, wasted deer nosing from forest onto threadbare fallows, starveling English, wraiths of butchered Norse, wintry eagle carrying crawd, quartering the common with salt-bleached, sunlit eye. Perennial rabbits, rats and hedgehogs, pen-released pheasants, exsanguinated hares, road splat scribblers, chaffinches, larks, kamikaze blackbirds, remarkable foxes, farm cats, stoats, sorrowful owls and hunt-blind hawks. Once a dog, some mutt stopping traffic, bright bloods pooling from the split in its skull. A badger near the fork to Clayton, proving they were back. The horse that wrote off the post office van. Stu Bennett staggering home from the night owl. The Mormons thrown from the rolled Datsun. Emergency services, magpies and crows, quotidian corpse disposal crews. Pole traps strychnine, gibbets strung with hook-billed vermin, danger to dogs. Shotguns and shillelaghs, Bridewell, assizes, eviction and jail. Holy partridge, sainted pheasant. Stuffed behind glass at Diamond's Burntwood Hall, false-eyed Chrysaetus Brown, the white-tailed eagle of 1898, mantling over a mangy hare. Seen soaring over Manface Quarry, a sign and a wonder for a carrion age, shot on general principle, fetched for the master's praise. My favourite word in any of the English languages is the Old English for sparrowhawk, spearhavok. This is a poem called Spearhavok, and I just tried to capture the spearhavok with several nods to my bird nesting past. I dedicate this to Barry Hines, Ken Loach, and David Bradley for the film Kez. And it's based on the Book of St. Albans, where a kestrel was for a knave, and I think a sparrowhawk was for a clerk. Because it says so in the first line of the poem. No cleric am I, yet a spurviter and a musketeer. My quarry, whatever the woods provide, nuthatch, bullfinch, long-tailed tit, deciduous or tollens, I calibrate by candlelight in screamless plywood muse, gauntlet, jesses, vitamin B12. Sharp sets frugal fare, gassed hatchlings, snap-trapped mice, boused in watered blood. Tight-fletched bow perch, tortoise catgut, wasp-eyed, frantic, bristling with blades. Sabbath dawn in the yeomaned wood, no cleric and yet no knave. Egg thief, scrumper of irises, plucker of pointless fowls. Red start, black cap, golden oriole. The last bird poem is about it's about an owl. I've been reading a book about the folklore of owls just before I took my dogs out one April night, and apparently in Yorkshire, where I'm from, the folklore says if an owl perches on your house, then someone is going to die. So my wife and I took the dogs out, and we came back, and there was an owl perched on the house. That was 3 years ago, so no one's died yet, but you never know. This is a poem loosely based on that. It's called What Is That Bird? What is that bird calling from the dusk? Spiritous mists are chilling the outside air. Close the window. There again, through the glass, a mournful pewit, a curlew's severed plaint, a loon's sinister atmospherics at Camp Crystal Lake. Turn off the light. Sit in silence by the window and listen through the stare of your black doppelganger as springtide darkness presses against the glaze. A blackbird's alarums, the frantic ticking of robins. Catnial, maybe, clawed paws flipping the lid of the tip box. Sally forth in carpet slippers, brandishing yard brush. Blackbirds and robins erupt, and haloed in the moon on the herringbone aerial. Athene noctua, presaging death in this suburb. These ghosts are drawn by my own fuming blood. My other obsession, apart from birds, is dogs. And you'll see my whippet turn up on here. My whippet is I'll just give you an anecdote about my whippet. I trained her to catch rabbits. She was very good at retrieving rabbits alive to hand. But one day she caught a squirrel and tried to retrieve that alive to hand, and it bit her savagely around the face. So she learned her lesson, and she's developed an extremely unfortunate habit, which is whenever she catches a squirrel now, she skins it by shaking it, and she disintegrates it before your very eyes. I went to a very genteel North Yorkshire village to meet a friend to go for a walk. It was about 9 o'clock in the morning. I opened the back doors of the van. She ran across the road, caught a squirrel, and did her thing in front of some scandalised local people. But this first poem is actually it's from Oswald's Book of Hours. It's the first poem in Oswald's Book of Hours. It's written in the voice of the young King Oswald. I imagine him as a kind of 7 or 8 year old boy out on his first hunting trip with his father, Athelfrith, in the Yorkshire Fen around Hatfield. It's prefaced with an epigraph from one of my favourite books and best written books that I've ever read. It's by Edward, Duke of York. It's called The Master of Game. I think it was written in 1415. And Edward says this: I say that hunters go into paradise when they die and live in this life more joyfully than any other men. We rose at daybreak on the Feast of the Holy Cross and rode to the chase, where we breakfasted in our tents. Apples and white bread and Frankish grape wine, fumes curling from the jar like dawn mist rising over the stank, scarlet as the eastern sky, as the boar's blood smeared on beardless cheeks by the index and middle fingers of Athelfrith, my father, who was pagan and barbarian and took me to hunt the Eofa in the water waste of Hatfield. where I leapt from my mount in the birch scrub by the Turbary to drive home the barbed iron in a tumult of pig shriek, yelping greyhounds, Alountess snarling, Mallard and Hernshaw panicking aloft. My father smiling, the roars and backslaps of war-gloried men. I tell you, it is no sin. This is a self-explanatory poem. It's I wrote a sequence of poems called "The Hours of the Virgin," but so it was a kind of it took its starting point from the Holy Office. But my "Hours of the Virgin" were all poems about dogs, particularly bitches. And this is about this is a nativity of sorts. She whelped in the front room in a basket by the hearth. The telly was on in the corner. Good morning, sports fans. The lad flipped it to SpongeBob and then went to do his papers. She'd done by the time he was back. Three dogs, five bitches. Blues and blacks, a fawn and brindle. Sire, Lord of the Night, from Mike Brown in Bridge End, killed the week he covered her, breaking his neck on a scarp at Torpantown, going hell for leather for a hare. The black dog was runty, kept falling off the tit. I gave it the weekend before drowning it in the sink. We made sure she ate well to keep her condition. Cottage cheese with powdered calcium, the pluck of a rabbit, beef brisket diced small. She was a good mother, barely leaving the basket for the first 3 weeks, licking and cleaning, giving good suck. Lads in flat caps and Jack Pike camo came calling. At 5 weeks, they were spoken for. At 10, all gone, bar the fawn and brindle boy, who we kept for our own use, and who was dead in 18 months, ripping out his guts on dusk-blurred barbed wire, going hell for leather for a hare. In Englerland, I've written a kind of a poem in an approximation to Old English alliterative verse. It's called Big Billy, and it narrates a day in the life of a kind of, set in 1920, it narrates a day in the life of a kind of hard man collier at the aforementioned Good Friday Wakes fair on Brierley Common. It's structured around, it's basically a takeoff of Beowulf, and it's modelled around the kind of three fights, four funerals model of Beowulf. This is the first funeral. It's the funeral of Billy's dog. Listen, lament for Laddie, the lauded long dog, hammer of hares, harrow of foxes, killer of conies, curse of field flush cats. Leash slipped, spuming, slaughter lust blinded, slaver tongue tight to a turning hare. He blood craze crashed through cruciate wire, first light this fair feast Friday morning. Gullet gashed, gralloped, gut snakes gleating, lig lacerate limp in the hoarfrost lay. Catgut crochet, the courser's catholicon, would wire no more the whimpering war dog hole. Big Billy built his backyard barrow and spadeback tamped the turf down tight. The shire-shouldered soil shifter stood and swaled the sweat from his swarth and said, "You were a bloody good dog." One of the reasons I wrote England really was about the kind of the amnesia that seems to have descended upon people in my area. The historical excavations, the archaeology of Brierley Common is completely unknown. That historic landscape, that possibly sacred landscape, has been progressively destroyed and chewed away by light industry, by farming, by utility works. And so whatever was there is now virtually impossible to see, but you can reconstruct what was there, and people are completely unaware of it. And this is I'm going to read a poem now which kind of concentrates on that theme. It's a poem called Bomb Drop. And it's about a kind of folk tale that developed post-Second World War to account for a piece of the landscape. And it's got a definite pit village or pit town context. As you probably know, I was brought up in a place called South Kirby, which in 1900 was a hamlet of 200 people. 30 years later, there were 7,000 people there, and by about 1950, it was a town of 1,300. All people coming from other parts of the United Kingdom to work in the pits and the associated industries. And you know, the local culture was utterly swamped by these people who didn't have a connection with the land. And I think this is where comes out in the poem. It's called Bomb Drop. A droning Dornier, fuming diesel, opened its bomb bay short of the pit, straining for height. TNT tumbled, blasting bedrock open. That's what it was, this crater in the arable earth to the west of Barlow's farm, the bomb drop. Everyone knew that. There were no alternative theories. How else to account for this gouge for no reason, with its crags of sheer sandstone, fissures and screes? There we made a tree swing, piled bales for clifftop diving, dug dens in soft stone caves. By middle school, we'd blown the myth. Eroding tool marks and vertical planes gave it up as a disused quarry, the Yellowstone load for the soot-black Broad Lane farms. But you couldn't tell them. They chose to cleave to the famous story, the German plane that missed the pit and bombed the autumn cornfield. They came from different earths to work here in the pits, slaved to shifts, slammed in red brick council estates, withered to work and the miners' welfare. They walked the weekend land as tourists, building meaning from locally available materials. Ignorance, fancy, fact and experience, coalescing as mythic consensus. The sandstone hearths are fallen, the fireside voices still. The Fielding quarry, a ridge in the rape field. Sons of colliers and long dead ploughmen walking their meaningless earth. This is a poem set in the great snows of I think November, December 2011. I went to walk over the aforementioned Brierley Common landscape, and this poem came out of the walk. Winter night walk. Blanketing snow has smothered the night in hush. Traffic roar absent. Cars drifted to their street lit curbs. Owls puffed up in hawthorns. Foxes quivering in holes. Just me on the path from Ringstone Hill. My bootsteps in the creaking snow. The only sound in the universe. Snow at night creates its own light. A soft luminosity dulling the world in glow. In which the footpath stretches before me. A blue slash through the winter wheat field. Moon illumined to the chopped horizon and the edge of a howl wood. I halt at the stile where the trees begin, in the silence of the snow. Bluebells lie dormant in the peaty loam, as they have at this time since the melting of the glaciers, before stone axes sounded in the forest and hand ploughs opened the sod. Perhaps it was these, our Neolithic fathers, who ringed henchstones on the hill, long smashed into wallstone by Puritan sledgehammers. Only the name and mystery remain. Clumped flakes are falling, bouffant and mute, effacing this time, but not place. And with the world buffered out, the spirits come jostling. Anglian farmers hauling home harvest, breaking bread in the beery ox gang. Saltburn Norse glistening with pig meat, feasting from East and West Hagues. Gleaners bearing baskets on balks and byways, cotters picking sticks in the gauzy asart, Vardo circled on a wood-smoked common, colliers in mufflers, ploughmen harrowing tilth. Generations have trod these humdrum acres, lives written and erased in the palimpsest of earth. But in the snow-still quiet of a winter's night, in mind, in fancy, or on the plasm direct, you can hear the cacophonous landscape calling, a fair field full of folk in clamorous reunion, saluting the mongrel blood that runs in the veins of kindred men. In 1992, I moved to a house that backed onto a field that belonged to Frickley Colliery, which was then a working colliery. My next-door neighbour was a fellow called Craig Emerson, who actually worked at Frickley Pit as an electrician, and we became good friends. I know my way around nature, and Craig didn't know his way around nature. We used to walk the pit site and the countryside around the pit sites. I would induct Craig into the wacky world of bird watching and animals and plants, and Craig would entertain me with ribald stories of pit life. Michael Heseltown, I think it was, announced that the pit was closing, and we watched the pit close. We watched the pit as it was dismantled, and Craig had a little catchphrase, which is the title of this poem, which narrates the end of Frickley Pit. It's called "A Sin and a Shame," and it's dedicated to Craig Emerson. From the summit of Broad Lane Tip, overlooking the path to Frickley Park and the York to Sheffield railway line, we watched the demolition crews taking down the pit. The washery and beltways, with their kestrel eyrie, are levelled already. The lamp room, its roof full of pipistrelles, bulldozed flat. The canteen, where on the way back from nesting, a kid could get a pasty and a lukewarm bottle of pop. And the offices, with their mown and clippered gardens, neat privet, cherry trees and thrush-spotted lawns. Heaps of smoking rubble. The twin towers of the winding gear remain until at the time appointed in the Hemsworth Express, a camcorder crowd gathers on the field at the back of our houses to see dynamite bring them down. The button is duly pressed, and through the rumbling dust, the horizon is clear to Houghton Pagnell for the first time in 100 years. Some muted woo! Then shaken heads and silence. Your Uncle Frank turns his back. Well, that's it then. And shuffles off along the path to Bradley Car Terrace, the path my granddad trod each Friday to join the queues at the wages windows and pick up his £15 and change. Thousands used to work here. You turn your face from the obliterated place at which you used to work and tell me again, it's a sin and a shame. There are no more words. As the crowd and security drift away, we walk up the hill and onto the pit, across the barren place where you delighted upon last year, the nest, I told you, was a little ring plover's. Change of tone. A long sequence in here in Englandland called it's about the British Empire and the legacy of the British Empire. So it's about the British in India amongst other places and the legacy of that in terms of the subcontinental immigration into this country. It's also about a local lad who I was talking to Ian Duhigg last Saturday, and Ian Duhigg knew this person. His wife used to work with him. The poem's called The Transmigratory Soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan. Muhammad Siddiq Khan was the leader of the 7-7 bombers and travelled down from Beeston in Leeds to lead that terrorist attack in there. The transmigratory soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan, incarnate in the elephant cavalry of world-seizing Jahangir and pitiless Aurangzeb's claw of disemboweling, passed from this world to the orgasmic boudoir. Bang and French wine in an orchard of mangoes, 72 virginal houris attendant. thus chained to the wheel. For rebirthings numbered as the beautiful names of Allah, Al-Kafid, Arafi. The transmigratory soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan, quickening in the Hindu womb, seeded in the service of Angrezi Sahibs, intriguing against the Nizam of Hyderabad. Strangled at birth, dug under the dust of the midnight peepal, enlightened out of graveyard earth by Durga's dirt pariahs. Reborn as sabred sepoy, sealing those sahibs into Kaligat's death hole, drawing down karmic justice, quartering by cannon. The transmigratory soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan, votary vehicled in Ranjit's rainbow Punjab, a fakir vending charms for alms. Vatula, Vayakula, sainted congener of sadhus and swamis, bosom to end as health, wealth, and merit. To the sahibs, not but a lousy beggar. To the mullahs, kufa, a shaitan of shirk, usurper of Allah, al-Ahad, al-Hafiz. Cost claimed him, death by typhoid and Pashtun Wali. The transmigratory soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan became carnal in the Khalsa's turbaned khaki, the rifled corpse pile in the Jallianwala garden. 1 million Indian Muslims banking the king's shilling. The plunderbucks closed and graveyards opened. Allah, Al-Mumit, Shiva, destroyer of words. Wagga's fugue bellicosity grieving Mahatma, Jinnah's brute bifurcation crudely blaspheming Kimball O'Hara's panentheist Tawheed. The transmigratory soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan wars from Mirpur's whirring wheels to looming Leeds, the paki-bashing heartland of the heartless West Riding. 3 generations. Keep your head down and get on with it. Fit in, we're English now, and Allahu Akbar. All 3 simultaneous. The same households, the same heads. Brothers chasing brown. Brazilian G-string sisters. Safra's Najib, prone on the pavement outside Majestic, bleeding from the heel print in his face. The transmigratory soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan, dutiful son, husband and father, mortgagee, volunteer, teaching assistant, role model Muslim and nice young man, reevaluates English existence. Who am I? What am I doing here? The Markazi Masjid has the answers to those questions, culminating in your democratically elected governments continuously perpetrate atrocities against my people all over the world, and your support of them makes you directly responsible, just as I am directly responsible for protecting and avenging my Muslim brothers and sisters. Until we feel security, you will be our targets, and until you stop the bombing, gassing, imprisonment and torture of my people, we will not stop this fight. We are at war, and I am a soldier. The transmigratory soul of Muhammad Siddiq Khan is lashed to the wheel for 7 times 70 rebirths. Tigers of Sundarbans, lions of Gir, Ishtihad's posturing peacocks. Allah Al-Asib Ar-Rahim. The sins of the fathers are visited on the sons to the 3rd and 4th generations. This is to be expected. Germany's Jews were the most assimilated in Europe. Rome's expelled for constant riot. Dark horizon. Some winter tree. Dark bird bunched on the topmost bough. Stay a while and share the vision. Name both bird and tree. And I can't believe my timings have worked. I'm going to end now with the closing sequence of the book, which is called The Song of the Yellowhammer. The conceit of the book is that of Englaland is that the whole book is a kind of retelling of Egil Skallagrimson's panegyric to Athelstan and to the English after the Battle of Brunanbuhr. Egil was a Norse mercenary who fought for Athelstan, and he was also a skald. And if you've read Egil's saga, you'll realise that he was a very good skald. So this is it's a kind of journey that starts in the Humber estuary and comes down into Yorkshire, and then moves across the whole country of England. So it's a kind of almost like a review of England in there. Those of you who are bird watchers might want to keep your eye out, see if you can spot the five English buntings that are referenced in the first part of the poem. And it begins with my translation of a section from Egil's saga as an epigraph. So this is the song of the yellow hammer. Athelstan, war wager, waster of weapon takes, humbler of hundreds, corpser of kings. Albion passes to Alfred's wolf whelp, abaser of armies, lord of lives and lands. Even the paths of the Highland deer belong to Ella's golden haired atheling. The Yellowhammer's song is the princeliest ditty of Deira's summer buntings, far surpassing Shadinus's reedy flat battery and the loose change rattle of the corn, proclaiming its paupered promise, a little bit of bread and no cheese. From the starveling clays of Lent to the mass of St. Michael's stubblefield plenty, the copsed and coveted arable hedgelands resound with the scribbler's wheezing demotic, sprigs summited from barebone quick, foaming may, shot hard unripened haws. Yellow Amer, tongue of the pale-haired Frisian barbarians, Hengist and Horsa of the wyvern skin, sons of Wheatgills, son of Wita, son of Vecta, son of Wotan, sire of Thunor, hammer of Hrungnir, daughter of earth. The Danelaw clays are streaked with beaten gold. Below the plough, the citrine Ingus blows. The byways are verged with travelling ragwort, Sunakai, Salno. Lion's teeth blaze from the field's rough fleece, seeded from the sun. The churls of Wessex are satisfied with their crust, and honour not the ploughman. Humber's plate is empty, Tees and Medway discontent. A wind from the east, the blown dunes fray, cadent citronella from candled gauze. The dragon-proud fleet of Ivar the Boneless floats moored on Humber like a raft of gerfowl. Squinted by blizzarding Baltic snow, flail foam and strafing sand, the bleached eyes of Ella, king of Northumbria, watching from the point. Ravenspurn's wind-whipped strand line, hood-stripped, bare-tonsured, becloaked as wandering Wotan, Weagles gathers driftwood in the wintry broken rose, tumbling petals of Schneammer falling. The white-tailed eagle's sunlit eye tracks Humber's gullet along ooze, dawn and ear to the soft blonde stones and saffron clays of Hampole, an orchard of yellow pears, aureate moon, soft light of xanthic tallow. Worn and dislocate, Celts ground on gravels in the vale below the priory, shredding their rainbows. Suffocate gapes and gasping gills give out. Kite and corvid, horn-billed erne sparring on the shoals. Beckwalk from Hampole to Holywell Wood in a back-ripping tunnel of hawthorns. Unbelieved fish fleeing up current before us, pike and barbel, chub, and in a man-deep plunge pool, hung in a sunshaft column of light, a trout flicked its tail, vanished. Whence the sturgeon? its English reds like occluded, occult. A 7-foot vagrant, forked bankside at Toton, armoured flanks packed with hard caviar. Others, exhaust Celts perhaps, found floating bankside at Barmby Dun and Bollam on Idle, stoned by frightened farm boys. Mercian Sabrina offers motored failsafe, silts glutted with styria from Purton to Tewkesbury to stone-bottomed Vernwy and Tanat beyond. At Oswestry's guffawing table, the simultaneous interpretation of Cadwallon and Pender, stripping the plate, unbuckling the bones, cleaving the noble jowl. Athelstan rests in Aldhelm's Abbey, jowled by cheek of the naked gardeners. Eden fallen to satiric Arcadia, couched in celebrity. Wessex, Essex, the only way, south and middle Siaxa, vortexing to when? The Saxons knew no north. Thunor at forge, poaching gold in the bellowing furnace. Then the overhead malletings of Mjolnir the helm splitter, shaping rings to deal in hall. The song from clashing metals shrills across the heath, auric fletchings from the anvil fleeing to the gauze. Coney cropped common, flaming with furs from Hague Hall to Hargate. In the Yellowhammer's glebe, Ebenezer in exile dreamed the people's anthem. 10 English acres, neither thrones and crowns, nor master's drop hammers, slamming and sparking, exploding men like bombs. From Biggin Hill to Church Fenton, the arable aches with song. Ploughmen and pilots raising tankards in the taverns until dusk throbs crimson from the cities of the west. Broadwing Spitfires sputtering home, break the anxious reverie, screaming squadrons of June's dark swifts. White cliffs littered with wheat and whin, gull-wheeled and flacked with jackdaws, demobbed from Burma to a prefab on the Vale and life on the Barnsley seam, ectrudger's sludge to Frickley Pit in dawn's drowsing serenade, the unknown familiar song. Those birds were never blue. The heavy horse of Winkhouse Farm no more. The plovered pastures put to plough, now forested in rape. The gauzy common scoured to muck and agrochemical brass. Feast and field folk banished. Golden lads and lasses pissing in the wind. Lehman Brothers, Kardashian sisters, the love of money is the root of all evil. Whore is to body, a slave is to labour, and celebrity to soul. In each case, ka-ching. 3-card mounty bank con men, conjuring profits and total loss. Breath of plugging air freshener, suffocate central heating. Tight shoes and top button. Door, car door, return. Podged, paralytic, stinking of lipids and anxious with cancer. Xmas, Valentine's, many happy returns. We escape to nature like a drowning man surfacing before going under again. The Tumblestone Cottage at Hampole Wood, bramble derelict and shooting with blackthorn. Chop bones, horseshoes, residual brassicas. The woodcock rides now clotted with pheasant. Keepers fishing for fur with nooses. Tractors trawling the ocean arable with ballying of steel. Cut the vines from the hoary crab tree. Plank the pens against the fox. Birth milk and mutton in backyard barn and byre. To each man his allotment. With plough-turned fieldstone, gentled hands, we'll build once more and lift the lintels of long-tumbled halls. A fair field full of folk, the Stoop Crofts of Ringston via Scoresby's Red Pikes and Daggard Mile End, the frosted fallows of Frickley's Winter Palace, stormed with driven hares, blasted bloodless by Yeoman Grapeshot, the truncheons of Orgreave, St. Peter's cutlassed field. Bismarck's maxim, following Clausewitz, divisions make it so. Stalin shrank not from exemplary slaughter and made a new world. Ditto Hitler, Truman, Bucktooth Salazar. Too much blood. I can't commit. Not Samuel, but Jeremy, accursed of God, a prophet. Fafnir at Nitahith, smug in his cavern of gauze, curls his coils around Otter's ransom. At the place where water springs forth, Sigurd unsheaths flame-edged Gram. The incomprehensible screethings of yellow hammers relay across the moor. Sigurd hacked out the worm's black heart with the anvil-cleaving blade. Fafnir's dying benediction, gold will be your death. Indeed, through greed, all men are monstered, but in blood is law and shriving. The dripping clot spitted, turning over fire. Dusk camped under piebald birches, the inscrutable song of the yellow hammer throbs in the gloaming like a raw saw. Drawn by the cookfire's golden glow, chattering nut hatches spiral down. Regin sleeping, Sigurd licking from fingers, pink froth foamed from Fafnir's broiling heart. The pricked ears of the man-wolf opened on Niederhath to the language of birds, the spite of nuthatches, sharp faces turned to earth and advantage, urging betrayal and accumulation. Enrich yourself, kill friendship and honour, slay the one that trusts. Like fishwives or lawyers, disinheriting children, picking the pockets of corpses. In the king's tent at Vinheath, Egil finished his praise. And the song of the yellow hammer sounded over the hazel field like a scald in hall. You are the people in the land. No, you are the people. No, it is your land. Shield wall, bristling with halberds, tusked like the Eifer. Thank you.